Welcome to All Sides. Juan Williams is a Fox News political analyst, a regular panelist on Fox News Sunday, and a regular substitute host for The O'Reilly Factor in a 10-year career at NPR. Juan was a host on Talk of the Nation, a senior correspondent, and a senior news analyst. Before that, he was a reporter for The Washington Post. He is the author of 6 books, including Eyes on the Prize, America's Civil Rights Years, and his most recent, Muzzled, The Assault on Honest Debate. He joins us to talk about that today from Washington. Welcome to the show, Juan.
My pleasure, and thanks for having me on.
Question for the listeners, referring back to the title of the book, do you believe that honest debate has been muzzled in the United States, and who do you think's to blame? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Juan, we played a cut from the interview when you were on the O'Reilly Factor last spring, the one that got you fired from NPR, when you said you were nervous boarding a plane with passengers dressed in Muslim garb. And I'm wondering, after all the dust has settled now, do you think you would have ever written this book if not for what happened between you and NPR?
No. I mean, certainly the first chapter of the book, Anne, is about the whole incident that brought this to the fore, which is, as you heard in the clip, a debate about with Bill O'Reilly about the fact that he had said on the ABC program The View that Muslims killed us on 9/11. That prompted Joy Behar, Whoopi Goldberg to walk off the set, and then Bill made clear that he was only talking about Muslim extremists and didn't feel that he had to say this repeatedly. And then on the next show that he had on the Fox News Channel, asked me, where did he go wrong? I mean, it was pretty open, you know, question to me. And I said, well, you know, in fact, you didn't go wrong. I'm not going to play politically correct games with you. The people who killed us on 9/11 were Muslim, and they cited their faith. They said they were involved in jihad as justification for these terrorist acts. And then I went on to say, and, you know, and next month will be 10 years after 9/11, I said that even now when I'm in airports and I see people who are dressed in Muslim garb, first and foremost, in my mind, identifying themselves as Muslim, then I have a moment of anxiety. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the quote that's taken, I think, in isolation to my feelings out of context, and it was used as justification by people like the Council on American-Islamic Relations to attack me as a bigot, used by NPR then to as a basis for saying I had violated their journalistic ethics and deserved to be fired. And the reason I feel that it was taken in isolation out of context is that I then go on to say, you know, I don't make judgments about Christians based on the behavior of Timothy McVeigh, the man who bombed the Murrow Building in Oklahoma City. I don't make judgments about Christians based on the behavior of the people at the Westboro Baptist Church who engage in those terrible rants at military funerals. And I spoke about the notion of America as a country of religious liberty, even as we properly acknowledge and honestly acknowledge, no political games here, that there is a link between radical Islam and terrorism.
Why do you think that we're so sensitive? You know, you can talk about abortion clinic bombings and all kinds of things that are done in the name of a religion. Why do you think Muslim extremists, there's a sensitivity for that where there is not, as you've pointed out in other places, you know, to something like Timothy McVeigh. He was a Christian. We didn't blame all Christians for his role in the Oklahoma City bombing.
Well, I think that clearly the country, the United States of America today, is in the midst of a terrific struggle over the idea that radical Islam is directly tied to terrorism. And so there are many American Muslims who are not tied to terror, and we are struggling to figure out how we deal with this as a civil liberties issue. Clearly, with the Patriot Act having been put in place, with all the changes we've seen at airports, you know, America is a changed place after 9/11. But part of this, I mean, you think of our history and the internment of the Japanese during World War II. Mm-hmm. You think about how we have been so quick to make claims during the Cold War about people who had ties to communists or who might themselves be communists with the McCarthy hearing. And now it comes to the moment where we're saying, well, wait a second, is it the case that we have an enemy within with regard to the Muslim community. And so we're having to make judgments fully aware of the mistakes that we as Americans have made in the past and not wanting to paint with a broad brush, understanding that, in fact, we want our fellow Americans who are of the Muslim faith to cooperate with us in order to stop future terrorist attacks. But at the same time, realizing that there may be people who have allegiances or sympathies to the terrorists because they are fellow Muslims.
My guest is Fox News analyst Juan Williams. He's calling us from Washington, and we're talking about his new book. It's called Muzzled, The Assault on Honest Debate. To our listeners, do you think that honest debate's being muzzled in the United States? If so, why? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also go to our Facebook page, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and post your question or comment there. You do a great job in the book pointing out that we didn't get here to this point in history, regardless of how you want to define the freedom of debate in this country, in a day. It's been over the course of our entire history that we've kind of been whittling our way to this point.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is that the whole notion of free debate is at the very essence of the founding of the United States, Dan. I mean, you think about the founding fathers and the arguments they had and the need for Madison to write the Federalist Papers to try to convince the states to confirm the Constitution that, you know, that there was an importance to a federal government, to the idea of all the states coming together to form a union. And by the way, isn't it interesting the degree to which they compromised? And I think compromise is often now a dirty word in American politics because everybody has to speak really in terms of I believe strongly in my principles and I will not budge. And we saw this in the terms of the debt ceiling debate where both sides just became so intransigent that we came to the edge of an economic cliff. I think it's damaged our economy in terms of investor confidence even to this moment. But anyway, you see this in terms of the founding fathers. You can come forward in terms of arguments over slavery. And then, of course, you can come forward in terms of arguments over westward expansion in this country. And I think if you go to the 1960s to make a leap, then you come to the idea that, oh, in service to the idea of equality, racial equality, gender equality for women as women were moving up in American society, in service to the idea that they were underserved populations of the poor, the disabled, we should have more neutral language, language that wasn't as weighted. And then you start to hear about politically correct speech, and then it becomes more enforced by people who are strongly of that mind, mostly on the left, saying, here are speech codes for the universities. We shouldn't have courses that are just filled with dead white men, books by dead white men, and all that kind of thing. And then there's a backlash against that kind of politically correct thinking. And then you get into the arguments over coming from the right, about sort of strongly evangelical community saying, oh, no, we want everybody to live according to the Bible and you should live this way. And then arguments over things like the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Oh, if you're against this, if you're not with us, then you're against this. And if you're arguing about the war, then you're less than patriotic. So there's speech codes that you see throughout American history that
get employed. And across the political divide.
Across the political divide from one side or another. And I think it's reached the point now where it's just out of control. That's why the subtitle of the book is The Assault on Honest Debate. You asked, Ann, would I have written the book if not for what happened to me at NPR? I think that's unlikely. But 90% of this book has nothing to do with the incident that I went through at NPR. 90% of the book is about the history of how speech and discussion, debate in this country is often inhibited by one side or another. And right now, with everybody speaking to the extremes, to the right speaks to the right wing and the left speaks to the left wing, everybody ignores the middle. Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, before she was shot in Tucson, she said, you know, there's no reward for trying to be reasonable, trying to understand the other person's point of view, for listening to the other person, not demonizing them. Mm-hmm. All the reward goes to politicians at the extremes. And the same is true in terms of people who are lobbyists, people who are representing advocacy groups. They want you to use their language in just the way that they speak. You mentioned abortion earlier. You're supposed to say that you are pro-life, suggesting that the other side must be anti-life, or you're pro-choice, suggesting the other side is trying to take away your choices. This is all intended to to limit honest debate in this society.
Right. It never gets beyond the labels and the talking points.
That's what I think.
You have some choice words for NPR, and I do want to get back to that later in the program, but you say that condoning political polarization goes well beyond NPR and that it's the rule rather than the exception in much of the media now.
I think that's right, because we have what I would call narrowcasting. We used to have broadcasting, people like Walter Cronkite, who would tell stories of America to Americans, and people had a high level of trust and credibility. And I don't think that, I know that I didn't, as a little black boy in Brooklyn, New York, think, oh, that Walter Cronkite, he's a liberal or he's a conservative. Later, people said he's very liberal, but I didn't know that. I just thought he was a newsman, and I thought he was telling me an honest account of what's happened today in America. Well, and the world.
And everyone was listening to the same thing.
Right. But now we have thousands of choices. I think I'm a little bit engaged in hyperbole there, but we have, you know, cable channels, 500
I don't know.
Cable channels and whatever.
I haven't gotten through all my cable channels
exactly.
yet, so I don't know.
but the idea is they're niches. And so people can go to one kind of news from a conservative slant, from a liberal slant, the same thing on radio. People complain largely about conservative talk radio. Conservatives complain about Hollywood movies being so liberal. Liberals complain about the Wall Street Journal editorial page being so conservative. Conservatives complain about the New York Times editorial page being so liberal. Everybody, it seems, goes to sources that confirm pre-existing opinions, ideas, and prejudices. They don't open their minds to hearing the other side so much. And the problem is then that they're not hearing stories that the other side is hearing. We're not all hearing the same stories. We all, it seems at times, have different sets of facts that are operating in our minds about the reality that we live in the same nation as Americans. It's bizarre, but as I say, it's not just the politics, it's not just NPR, it's all over. Everybody, it seems, now occupies a niche space. You certainly see it on the internet. Oh my gosh, you go, you know, if you are a certain type of Republican, then you go to a certain site, and if anybody varies from the orthodoxy being advocated at that site, then they are to be marched off. You know, they're treasonous, they're betraying the cause, they're not really Republican, or they're not really one of us, they're to be ostracized, they're a rhino Republican in name only. This kind of thinking is now contagious. I mean, it's all over our society.
And, you know, you get into the issue and the idea, the concept of orthodoxy and how it relates to George Orwell's 1984.
Well,
the thought process.
I think that's right. I think that all of a sudden everybody finds themselves in a situation where you will be, as I said, marched off and said that you are subject to being re-educated because you don't really understand our point of view. And if you're not understanding our point of view, then you're with the enemy and that you're not to be trusted. And I mean, I think it's just craziness. And yet it's so common now in American society, this sense of clubbiness that you're either with us or against us. That in the book, I use the analogy, and that, you know, it's like people who are tremendous fans of, let's say, the Cleveland Indians or the Cincinnati Reds. And then one day, you know, the teams are playing and they're hating each other and they demonize each other. And somebody says, hey, you know what? Both of you are tremendous baseball fans. You both love the game. And it takes some of the sparkle away and the energy away from their passion because they're no longer able to hate the other side. But I think that's the larger point. Why is it that we don't have debates and conversations about good ideas, bad ideas, about what works in terms of service to solving big problems in American society, be it, let's say, the immigration problem. It could be budget issues like the debt ceiling. It could be something like how to deal with terrorism. Why can't we have these discussions in an honest way that leads to good ideas surfacing and then being enacted and solving problems?
Well, how much do you think that has to do with the fact that people suspect motives when one group of people thinks and religiously thinks or believes to the core of their being that the president isn't even from the United States, wasn't even born in the United States? They suspect motives.
They certainly do. Well, I mean,
so you can listen to all the rational, what is appears to be rational conversation, but if you suspect the motive,
exactly. And let me just say that it's not that you don't want someone to say, "Hey, I think the president wasn't born in the United States." You want to say to them, "Well, what's the evidence? Where's the proof?" I want to have the conversation. I don't want to shut you down, but I do want to know what's the basis for this. And when you fail to produce any evidence and you continue down that road, at that point, I say to you, you know, it seems to me like your motive here is one of this total distaste for the president, but I'm not sure that it has a rational basis. I want to be able to say that to the person. I want the person to be able to hear me, but I don't want to shut you down and say you can't say it. No, please. But once at some point, it then crosses the line from a discussion about the facts and how we need to move forward as a society and as a nation, and into something which is like a personal animus that you have directed towards the president, a politician in the United States.
My guest is Juan Williams, author and Fox News analyst. We're talking about his new book, Muzzled, The Assault on Honest Debate. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
FM is your source for NPR news and local news. Stay up to date with issues impacting life in Central Ohio. The award-winning WOSU News team keeps you connected to the community, and the State House News Bureau has the latest in-depth coverage of state government. Listen to news from across the country and from our own backyard on 89.7 NPR News and streaming online at WOSU.org.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. Stay right here at 11 o'clock for hour two of the program and a conversation with OSU President Gordon Gee. That discussion begins at 11.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners and investment managers providing financial advice and client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life at sherringtongroup.com.
69 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunny skies today, and we'll get up to a high of 82. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Juan Williams. He's a Fox News analyst. We're talking about his new book, Muzzled, The Assault on Honest Debate. Do you think that honest debate has been muzzled in the United States? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Fox, there's been a lot of comparisons between NPR and NPR orthodoxy, and some critics of yours, people who criticize you, say, well, Fox has its own orthodoxy. Fox News business analyst and host Stuart Varney tried to question his boss, News Corporation chairman and CEO Rupert Murdoch, about the hacking case when it first appeared in 2009, and Rupert Murdoch quickly reprimands his employee. Let's listen.
The story that is really buzzing all around the country, and certainly here in New York, is that the News of the World, a News Corporation newspaper in Britain,
I'm not talking about that issue at all today. Sorry.
Okay. No worries, Mr. Chairman. That's fine with me.
Okay, I for some people, I don't know what's disturbing, whether the Rupert Murdoch say he doesn't want to talk about it or how Stuart Varney responded to it. But Murdoch and his son James are to be questioned about the phone hacking scandal under oath in the High Court in the UK. It's a worldwide news that has implications in the U.S. So I'm wondering, would you hesitate to comment on or raise the issue of the phone hacking case in your role at Fox News? Has anyone dealt with it there to your satisfaction?
Oh, my gosh. Gee, and I mean, they not only have they dealt with it, it was when Rupert Murdoch testified before Parliament, it was on the ear constantly. They covered the whole thing the whole day long. So it has been covered now. I've even read criticisms about how the Wall Street Journal, which is also owned by News Corp, which is another Murdoch entity, you know, as well as Fox News Channel, didn't ask and persist in the way that the New York Times people would have liked. But, you know, I mean, it seems to me that the coverage is there. I don't think there's anybody who can dispute that. Whether or not the coverage has been sufficiently aggressive or critical is another element to be questioned, and I'll leave that up to the critics, but I don't think there's any question about the sufficiency of the coverage.
Susan in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, you all have made my point much better than I could. I really do believe we are completely muzzled from both sides. It's extremely difficult to find any conversation that's not on the extreme end in Fox News and Rush Limbaugh on the right, in MSNBC and CNN on the left. It's it's very difficult as a consumer. If we watch both sides, all we get is the extreme view on both sides. It's hard to know what good news is anymore. And I also wanted to say that I really was horrified by your firing, and I really miss hearing you on NPR.
Well, I appreciate it very much. And you know, I mean, one of the realities for me is that when this first happened to me, I was personally so threatened. I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, my whole career, something I built as my life is gone. And then it quickly became apparent to me that this was a bigger story than me and that other people like you had the sense that you can't say anything in this country. You can't have an honest discussion where you're trying to learn from the other person or saying, oh, I think you might have a point here, because then people will say, well, you're not a good conservative or you're not a good liberal or something, that it's hard to have an honest conversation. And I think as I said to Anne, that's why there's only the first chapter of the book that's about the NPR thing. The rest of it is about this larger issue of how difficult it is to have an honest conversation these days.
Well, and we are all the poorer for it. So thank you for the book.
Thanks for the call, Susan. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you want to join the conversation. We're asking our listeners to tell us first if they believe and agree that honest debate in the United States has been muzzled. If you have, let our screener know, 614-292-8513, and tell us why. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We entered sort of, Juan, a new era of political correctness after 9/11. You mentioned earlier everything seemed to change then.
I think that's right, because at that moment the country was under attack, literally, and we had debates about exactly what are the limits of civil liberties at that moment. And, of course, the debate was very stilted. I mean, it was the debate over the Patriot Act. And to this day, we have had extensions to the Patriot Act without really allowing for further debate in any significant way, so that we have incursions on everything from, our travel to our telephone communications to our internet communications to our mail. And people are reluctant to get involved in the conversation, because if you do, you'll be subjected from people on the left saying this is, Orwellian, and or that from people from the right who would say you're not really patriotic and you're opening us to the possibility of future attacks. It's more evidence of how the left is weak on defense. And so both political parties locked into their bases, fearing the other side, doesn't even have the conversation. And, of course, civil liberties are at the base. They are the essence of American democracy, that we protect individual rights and privacy in our society and property and the rest. And yet we don't have this conversation today, post 9/11. Again, another example of how we are frozen and incapable of having an honest debate without demonizing the other side.
You bring up gerrymandering. You know, we're in the redrawing the districts again. That's the euphemism, I guess.
Right. Not you and me.
The political powers that be are redrawing the political lines, subdivisions in the United States right now per the latest census numbers. Talk about how gerrymandering has contributed to this problem, because I can't see it going away anytime soon.
Well, the number one issue, if you're a politician in America, and I'm speaking in general terms here, is retaining power. People want to get reelected. They want to hold on to power. And the way that the politicians do it, given that every 10 years there's a census and there's redistricting, is they've increasingly drawn the district so as to concentrate people of like mind, so that if you are a Democrat and in power to make this decision, you try to put in place a large number of Democrats who will continue to elect your official to Congress. Well, this is interesting, because what it means is that the politician really only is speaking then to Democrats, and he's speaking to the base of that Democratic Party, and he's not considering Republican points of view. He's not considering even moderate points of view in many cases, because the fear he has is that somebody from the left, from farther left, will challenge him and say he's not sufficiently Democratic to his all-Democratic base. Well, this is true on the Republican side as well. You take someone like Senator John McCain. When Senator McCain was having trouble in Arizona, his trouble came not from someone who was in the middle or even from the Democrats in a strongly Republican state. It came from the far right, from J.D. Hayworth, a talk show host, who was saying that Senator McCain is not to be trusted, he's too moderate in his views. And so then on a key issue like immigration in Arizona, suddenly you saw Senator McCain swing wildly to the right. And this goes on in not only in a statewide race like Senator McCain's, but in every single congressional district now around the country. And I might add, Ann, you see it also in terms of race and ethnicity, that you see concentrations of minorities in certain Democratic districts. This helps the Republicans. Republicans are happy to go along with it because it means that they don't have to speak for these minority groups that most often vote Democratic anyway. So you see concentrations of Republican voters in Republican districts, and all the conversation then is from the far right.
You know, Senator Kaine had his roots in independent thought. He was considered something of a rebel. It seems like a lot of the folks coming in now have their roots in the polarized scenario we're in now.
Exactly. And
they've never even felt the feeling of what it's like to just say what you really think.
Well, in fact, I think that, remember, Senator McCain was known as a
maverick.
Senator
McCain, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was the great thing about him. I mean, that I think drew lots of people, but specifically independents, to Senator McCain. But he had to give up that reputation in order to hold his Senate seat by swinging, as I said, wildly to the right.
And do you ever wonder, have you ever talked to him about that and what that feels like?
Yeah, and you know what he says is that he has to represent the people of Arizona, and he has to be politically savvy and get reelected. I don't think there's any, I understand what he's saying, but to me, as I indicated to him, I just thought, you know, that's not the Senator McCain, well, that I knew, and from his perspective, who cares what I think? You know, I'm a journalist. I'm not the one who's up there to get reelected, and he wants to be a U.S. Senator.
Well, all the people waiting to talk to you care what you think. If you want to talk to Juan Williams, 614-292-8513 is the number to call. You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Jerome from Marysville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jerome.
Thank you, Ann and Mr. Williams. Your screener made me summarize what I had to say in a few sentences, but I just want to say that I agree with Juan Williams that it is almost impossible to have a dispassionate, critical debate. And I can cite examples from NPR, academia. We've seen it in the state legislature here in Ohio recently, public schools, you know, right down to, you know, I think we see examples of it, you know, on WOSU. I've seen examples of it in my own Temple, and I'd be happy to give the examples, but your screener said to just sort of keep it short.
Well, Jerome, why don't you give us an example at WOSU?
I was very dissatisfied, to be honest, Ann, and you know this, with the discussion you had after Juan Williams was fired, the discussion you had with the ombudsman. I'm as much as I like your program, I think the shift in format has narrowed the spectrum of people who can get on and have a voice within the local community. I really miss the wide range of debates that happened when we had open lines.
You're talking about Alicia Shepard, when Alicia Shepard was on,
yeah.
Juan, soon afterwards, Juan Williams. And what about that did you feel like wasn't getting out?
Not getting out was Juan Williams' discussion. I think it should have been a three-way discussion. Mm-hmm. I think Juan Williams ended up getting tarred and feathered on that day because all this background stuff got dragged in, and Juan never had a chance to defend himself.
Yeah, that brings up an interesting point because, of course, Juan, we tried to get you on the show, as we, of course, would. But because of the 24-7, you're calling it now the 20, I don't know how many minutes are in a day, but you're saying however many minutes in a day, 7 days a week, the news cycle is just pounding at it.
It sure is. I mean, this news is constant. But I mean, obviously, I didn't hear the conversation that the caller, that Jerome is talking about, but I mean, to me, it's an important point. I would have liked to have been able to respond, but, you know, I don't know when the show aired, but clearly this whole event happened late October of last year, and at that time I was just besieged. I was under sea in terms of the number of people who were trying to reach out to me, and I don't know if that is the case.
Oh, I'm sure it was, but you can't get everybody all at the same time on any given program.
Right, and I certainly appreciate being here today, but I think Jerome's point is that maybe he felt it was one-sided. I don't know, but from my perspective, what I know is that, this is one of the fears I had when this thing first happened, Ann, is that NPR is such a loved brand in the world, and especially among the left, and especially upper-income, highly educated people, university people just love NPR. And my fear was, you know, that since NPR is so powerful and has a microphone in every town, that I was going to be tarred and feathered, and it sounds like that's what happened with the ombudswoman calling and speaking to you.
Thanks a lot, Jerome, for that call. 614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call, you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk about NPR now. You're critical of NPR. You do talk about the incident in the first chapter, but later in the book, you also talk about funding for NPR and what the federal government, what kind of obligation it owes an institution like NPR.
Right. Well, when this thing first happened, this was all around the time of the midterm elections last year when the Republicans gained the majority in Congress. And almost immediately thereafter, then, Republicans cited this case as evidence of why they thought federal funding for NPR should be withdrawn. And I stayed out of it altogether, and I didn't want any part of it because I didn't want people to say, oh, he's just being vindictive or he's just so bitter and angry, sour grapes, all the rest. But several months later, I think it was early this year, as that battle over NPR funding continued, a Democratic congressman who was in charge of the Democratic Congressional Committee, Steve Israel, wrote a letter to constituents in which he said, we have to defend NPR funding because NPR is the answer, the antidote to Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity. And it occurred to me in that instant, I thought, wait a minute. So in other words, Democrats are saying that NPR is their firewall, it's their voice. And so NPR journalists have to then worry that if they do anything that would displease Steve Israel and the Democrats, that the Democrats then would forsake them or stop defending them. And, you know, I just thought this is a mess. Journalists don't deserve to be in that position, should not be in that position. NPR, by their own admission, says that the federal funding amounts to like 2 or 3% of their overall budget. And I think that given the passion that the NPR audience has for the product, given that advertisers would love to have access to that highly educated, influential audience, I don't see why NPR can't just compete and be out in the general market, much the way the New York Times is, much the way the Washington Post is, and succeed without having these political pulls because of this 2 or 3% that they say comes from the federal government.
You've talked also, the last time you were on the program, about the local affiliates of NPR and how the machinery works. And a lot of the federal funding, a lot of the money they spend to buy NPR programming comes from federal grants.
Correct.
And a lot of people equate that with NPR funding.
Well, no. I think that what you have is money that flows through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and then goes to the individual stations. And those stations make decisions about what they buy with their money. And, of course, they can make any decision they want. But that's not what we're talking about when we're talking about the funding. By its own admission, NPR says, as I just described to you, 2 to 3% of the money that they in their budget that comes directly to NPR from the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
The local stations like OSU, to my mind, are playing such a critically important role, especially in this era when you see smaller and smaller newspapers, smaller and smaller number of newspapers, and smaller number of news pages in newspapers, and more of the kind of if it bleeds, it leads attitude on nightly news and nightly local news, that NPR stations are oftentimes a critical element in terms of providing local news coverage, local talk like your show, so that people can have voice and can be heard about what's going on in their community. That's quite separate. In other words, OSU is not NPR, and NPR is not OSU. OSU has its own management, leadership team, its own audience, its own constituency, funders, et cetera. separate from NPR. I think people get that confused often, but OSU can buy products from Public Radio International. They can buy it from Minnesota Public Radio. Mm-hmm. They can create their own programming, and it's not necessarily tied into any decision being made here in Washington by National Public Radio.
My guest is Juan Williams, author and Fox News analyst. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Muzzled, The Assault on Honest Debate. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
FM is your all-day NPR news station. Listen to local and national news all day, every day. And you can hear the best in classical music on Classical 101. Listen to your favorite composers 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. It's 89.7 NPR News and Classical 101 from WOSU Public Media. For more information, visit WOSU.org.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. In just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, a conversation with OSU President Gordon Gee. That's during Hour 2 of All Sides with Ann Fisher. And you can join WOSU for a Chefs in the City Ohio beer tasting at the historic Granville Inn on September 14th. Local food hors d'oeuvres will be paired with a selection of beers from four of Ohio's best breweries. Tickets are on sale now for $45 each. Visit WOSU.org/chefs to reserve your tickets.
Support for 89.7 comes from Thurber House, presenting author Mona Simpson, offering a glimpse into the world of privileged Hollywood households in her latest novel, My Hollywood, Tuesday, August 30th at the Columbus Performing Arts Center. Tickets at ThurberHouse.org.
Sunshine today and a high of 82, partly cloudy tonight, a low of 61. Sunshine and a slight chance of rain for Wednesday, a high of 82. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking with Juan Williams, the Fox News analyst and also author of a new book, Muzzled, The Assault on Honest Debate. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you want to talk. You can also tweet us at Ann Fisher, WOSU, as did Kilted Cleric. They wrote, "I think we can't debate because we are too busy offending. We need to learn to argue civilly, not just shout over each other." We have an email from Ben. He writes, "I find it troubling that if I, as a white man, criticize the president, it makes me a racist, or that my opinion is based solely on color. I find it incredibly offensive that I can say the exact things against this president as I did against Bush, and I'm the one in the wrong. When I voiced my opinion about Bush, I was exercising my right to criticize our leaders, but with Obama, I'm a bigot. I truly believe that the media does not help. On the left-leaning news sources, they seem to throw around the word racist to silence all those that disagree." Juan Williams?
Well, I think that, you know, this is a big issue. The fact is that it's possible. I don't even know that I need to say it's possible. I think it's obvious that you can disagree with President Obama's policies without being a racist or a bigot. But that's part of now the ammunition being lobbed against people who want to criticize the president. Now, I must say that we talked earlier about people who want to say, well, he wasn't born in this country, or he's a socialist, or who depict him, you know, in signs as the evil Joker. That stuff makes you wonder, gee, is something going on here? Why is there so much hatred directed towards the president? But on the other hand, I think there is legitimate criticism to be offered of the president without having people demonized as racist for simply offering, as Ben was saying, legitimate criticism of a public official who should be held accountable for his performance in office.
Kevin, in Columbus, you're on the air. You want to talk about race as well. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, that's the common thread, and I'm really sick and tired of everyone skirting around it. We need to expose some of these Tea Parties. It's the small bastion of, I don't know if they're older whites that have a secure, when they retired or they got a lot of money. It is crazy. It's crazy. And so we need to stop the whole machine and say, this is really what we need to have this kind of, and here's the opportune time.
Okay.
We can really root out. We got the cancer almost cornered. They organized themselves. I'm not saying all of them, but I'm certainly saying 80%.
Okay.
This is absolutely crazy.
Well,
we have a whole atmosphere of banter going around this, and the nucleus atom is right before us.
Juan Williams, what are your thoughts about that? Is there something that we can root out, whether it's on one side or the other, that's going to turn this around?
I don't know about root out, but I think you can identify it as the caller was saying. I think that he's right when he says that there's lots of people who have this kind of strong, passionate distaste for President Obama. For example, I think we saw it last year in terms of the arguments over the health care, the Affordable Health Care Act, the Health Care Reform Act, and it came down to largely white seniors who were absolutely upset at the idea that their Medicare, Medicaid benefits might be lessened, decreased in service of changing the health care plan in this country. And it just became so vicious and angry, and that's when you saw the whole episode with the congressman walking in to make the vote and claiming that they were spit upon and called the N-word and all the rest. But that was never proven. But the idea is that's the heart and soul of a lot of the animus that then gets locked in, and a lot of the arguments that we've had just recently about the debt ceiling, again, comes back to the freshmen who said, freshman members of Congress who said, no, we can't even consider raising taxes on the upper income in this country, something that the overwhelming majority of Americans and Republicans agree and is a good idea as part of a package that also includes large cuts in spending and entitlements. But they said, no, we won't even consider that. And so I think lots of people like the caller feel like, wait a second, it's that element, that far-right fringe, that's now not open to honest debate, to honest compromise, that they won't compromise about anything, and people feel absolutely thwarted in trying to engage them in an honest conversation about the needs of America, what's best for our country.
Thanks, Kevin, for that call. We appreciate it. Harrison in Cleveland, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello?
Hi, Harrison. You're on the air. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we're discussing is merely the symptom and not the disease. Clinging to highly polarized and simplistic views and passionately using that as some sort of reference point to champion this or that cause comes from actually your mind being so distracted you can't even hear the words, quite honestly.
You mean distracted by all of the input?
Yes, that's part of it. You become distracted, and when the populace becomes distracted, then the only way to relate to them is to give them very simplistic things to that they could emotionally react to. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, this is an interesting point.
And when you emotionally react to an oversimplified talking point, you know, to like label or talking point, that makes you even more stupid and more unable to even hear the words.
Almost physically unable.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. You literally, I will give you an example, and I wish I had the specific facts, but to me it was very disheartening during the president gave an address. I can't remember which address it was. Oh, I think it was for the State of the Union. And afterwards they had the commentators. I was listening to Channel 19, which is CBS, that one of the major commentators talking about what the president said, and it was not what the president said. Literally.
Okay. So you're okay, Juan?
Well, I'm fascinated by this point. I find it very interesting, Harrison, because what you see is that people will now, use sound bites or They can't even hear, because what happens is that that they use these labels in order to, I think, limit the further discussion, the honest discussion of the entirety of the debate. And so people get locked into one position or another. Again, people going to voices that affirm pre-existing attitudes and opinions, people not being willing to hear the other side. And I think that's the problem that Harrison is talking about.
You know, you were talking earlier about dispassionate critical debate, and do we really want it to be dispassionate? What's wrong with passionate civil debate?
No, nothing wrong. If I said dispassionate, no. That's not the right word. It's not that I want passion. I welcome passion. If somebody wants to say what's on their mind, I want to hear what's on their mind. And if they want to say it passionately, I want to hear it passionately. Although I don't want to be threatened or intimidated by their passion, I just want to hear the power of what they have to say. But then I want them to understand that they too have to hear the passion of what I have to say, and that they could open their ears and listen and not demonize me in order to shut down the discussion. You know, I just feel like Harrison is hitting on something where people don't feel that they can listen to the other side anymore. They feel like, the other side is to be demonized, is to be caricatured, the reward now comes for people who stand up and scream at the president, "You lie." All of a sudden, his fundraising coffers get filled up by the base that's excited that somebody is willing to speak in such angry, passionate tones to the president, to take him on. Or you get people on the left then who say similarly harsh things, but they don't understand why the president isn't speaking in harsh language back to the critics. It's like everybody wants a big fight, but they're not talking about solutions to big issues. That's the law.
You wrote that many hoped that President Obama would scale the barriers that prevent honest and open debate, but that either he never intended to cross the political divide to really debate the right wing, or he did not have the political skills to do so. And I was wondering, is it really an either-or thing? I mean, is he the only factor involved? Is it that simple?
No, clearly he's had a Republican opposition that has decided, to quote Senate Majority Leader, Senate Republican leader, I should say, Mitch McConnell, that they want this president to be a one-term president. And they have, uniformly opposed his major legislative proposals. And certainly we saw that on health care, but we've seen it even recently in terms of the debt ceiling debate. You know, clearly debt ceilings have been raised over the years. Over the last 50 years, most of the debt ceiling increases have come for Republican presidents. But all of a sudden for this president at this moment, huge opposition, refusal to negotiate the talking points. So that, I think, then leads people to think, it's not just Obama, but my point in the book is that the president said he was going to find a new avenue, that he was going to be the kind of president who was a game changer, and that he knew how to create this bipartisan atmosphere. And the fact is, just the hard fact is, that he hasn't done that.
Harrison, thanks for that call. We're running out of time. I have an email from Angie in Hilliard. She says, "I agree that moderates are not being heard, so let's move into action. Juan, please get us moving toward a middle ground media source. Ann and her predecessor, Fred, model the value of taking the devil's advocate stance no matter the issue or question. It's up to all of us to take back the habit of indeed hearing all sides and insisting upon the evidence." Any hope, Juan, that we can achieve that goal?
Well, I think the hope, Ann, is I happen to be a fan of your show, and I think that people can hear all sides on your show, and I think you welcome voices. But I had a conversation with Jon Stewart recently, and what Jon Stewart and I were talking about was that there's going to be a next generation of media in this country, and that there's an appetite that people, the viewers, the listeners, the readers, they are tired of the sound bites and the demonization. And they know there's a lack of credibility to getting their news just from one side, from one source. They're looking for people they can trust. They're looking for people who will reward their interest. When Harrison was speaking, the key point I thought was it's hard for the average consumer of American media, because they're bombarded by so much media, to know what to make sense of. So they pick out one personality or another. They say, "I like that person, and I'm going to listen to them," or "I'm pretty much conservative, so I'll listen to a conservative personality." And then that person ends up telling them what to think. And that's dangerous. That's dangerous. You need to think for yourself, but it's hard because there's so much media around us. And I think that, in answer to Harrison, I think part of this is you have to be a very aggressive media consumer if you're not going to get fooled in this environment. And that picks up on Angie's point. You've got to be willing, I think, to understand that if there's an increased appetite on the part of viewers, listeners, readers, then the American media will start to satisfy it. And I think that's the hopeful point. I think more people want media that's not partisan, that's not tilted heavily to one side or another.
And what about the folks in the legislature, whether at the state level or the federal level? I was at a conference earlier this spring on civility and democracy, and one of the resolutions of the group was, we need more leaders, people who are willing to lead. And right now you're saying that the defeat of George H.W. Bush to Bill Clinton signaled that politicians in office can't change their minds on an issue in response to changing realities.
Well, I think they have a hard time. I think that at the moment, the money in politics flows from the base. It flows from the extremes, from the far left and far right. You look at what's going on in the Republican race right now for the Republican presidential nomination. 70% of the vote in the Iowa straw poll went to Michelle Bachmann, and Ron Paul. And again, I think that what you're seeing there is people who are saying, you know, we are part of an extreme base here. We're not talking about people in the middle in any sense. That's not where the energy is. That's not where the money is. And again, it has the impact of limiting conversation to people of like mind who then have litmus tests as to how conservative or how liberal you can be.
And therefore, maybe how unable to lead at the in the final analysis.
Well, but where are you going to get a? You know, we elect our leaders. We're a democracy. Mm-hmm. We put people in positions of power, and we trust them to be accountable and to exercise that power with some care for our best interest. But all of a sudden, what you see is that the leaders we identify are coming from the extremes, and so they respond to the demands of the extremes in order to get affirmed, to get the money and the votes and the political organizations in place. And I think that is part of what is clogging our ability to have honest debate of major issues in our society. I mean, it's like people were saying, if you want to be critical of the other side, now you can be called a racist or a bigot in my case, or fired in my case. You can be ostracized, thrown out of the group. You know, you're not a good Republican, not a good Democrat. It just gets ridiculous. And in fact, ridiculous is the word. I think it was 72% of the American people said Congress in the debt ceiling debate, their behavior, their actions were ridiculous.
Ridiculous is the word that's been tossed around a lot. Juan Williams, thanks for joining us today.
And thanks for having me. I appreciate that very much.
It's Juan Williams. He's a Fox News analyst and author of a new book. It's called Muzzled, The Assault on Honest Debate. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.